Rise to Rebellion, Disc 7.
Chapter 17. Franklin. London, December 1773. The grievances had been read aloud, and now the two men stood a few paces apart, separated by the hard chill of winter wind. They stared at each other with a growing uncertainty, all the voices quiet now, the fiery anger of their letters long gone, the words mute, the emotion now condensed into this one place, this one deadly moment. Both men could feel the strange emptiness, a blossoming fear emerging through the anger brought by the sudden awareness, the voice whispering in each other's mind, "Now is the time, and you are alone, absolutely alone." Each man felt the weight of the pistol in his hand, could hear the words of the man between them, meaningless ritual, the absurdity, as though anyone would need to hear anything about rules. The words stopped again, and the third man slowly backed away out of the line of fire. They stared hard at each other's eyes, tried to see some sign of weakness, the other man's cowardice perhaps betraying itself, the slight tremble in the hand spreading to the man's mind. But both men kept their hard focus, and now there was an icy silence, the onlookers holding their breaths, each man hearing a hard thunder in his ears. Some of the onlookers felt tears, helplessness, the last bit of hope fading away. All the hot talk, the shame, the hostility had finally brought these two men to this place, where each would summon the awful fortitude he would need to kill the other. Many had prayed it would not happen this way, that it was only talk after all, but these were men of pride and strength. And on this cold, bright day, not even fear could dampen the muzzle of the guns. The man in the middle was clear now, and there was a new voice, something about God, but neither man heard, each now staring hard through the red thunder in his brain. The pistols slowly began to rise. Then there was a brief pause, the final bit of hesitation, the guns not yet aimed. But the fire would not die, neither man losing his determination, not while the other still faced him. With a slight waver, the pistols rose again, and each man looked into the eyes of the other, the last doubts now swept away, and they fired. Franklin could hear voices downstairs. Mrs. Stevenson, then a man's, an urgency that interrupted his careful examination of the newspaper. He stood, moved to the door, opened it, saw the man coming quickly up the stairs, Mrs. Stevenson below, sounding upset. "Dr. Franklin, I tried to stop him." The man burst past him now into Franklin's room, and Franklin waved to her. "It's all right, madam, no harm." He closed the door, looked at his visitor. "What has happened, Mr. Temple?" The man was breathing heavily, moved in short lurches, pacing in quick turns. "I nearly killed him, that damned stubborn fool. He brought it on, all his public ranting. The last thing I ever expected was a duel. But he wouldn't stop, wouldn't leave it be." Franklin felt suddenly deflated, sat down heavily. "So you went through with the duel?" "I heard about the challenge, but I never believed." He let his head sag, the air leaving his chest, stared down at the floor. "Are you injured?" "By the grace of God, no. But I shot him. He'll live, they say. And now I hear from his people that he's still determined to see this through. He wants to do it again. William Whatley didn't get his just revenge. His brother's honor is still violated." Temple stopped pacing now, and Franklin looked up at him, saw defeat in the man's face, thin shoulders slumping under his thick wool coat. Franklin felt a rumbling depression spreading through his mind. "Mr. Temple, I truly never believed. You must be assured that if I had ever thought it would go this far..." Temple sat. "It has gone this far, sir, and it's bound to go farther. As long as William Whatley believes I took those damnable letters from his brother's effects, as long as the whole of England is told that I am responsible for the treachery... Have you seen the newspaper, sir?" Franklin's depression pushed him into motion. He moved slowly to the window, stared out into the late gloom of the afternoon. "Yes, I've seen them. I believed this whole affair would simply pass. The public would lose interest. I did not believe that Mr. Whatley would bring such a passion to the matter. He has passion enough for us all, sir, and there is energy behind him as well. Franklin turned away from the window, looked at Temple. What do you mean? You know that I am one of the few Americans who work in the employ of the King's Customs Office. A great many men of prominence come through there, and no one seems to care if I hear what seems to be sensitive talk. There are quite a few who speak frankly that there is more than family pride prodding Mr. Whatley, much more at stake than his damaged feelings over the theft of a few of his brother's letters. Gossip, Mr. Temple. Forgive me the insult, Dr. Franklin, but you are either a victim of arrogance or you are simply naive. Hutchinson's letters have become more than just the untidy musings of an unpopular governor. They have become a tool, an excuse for the ministry to make some response. There is talk of harsh measures, swift punishment. Whatley claims the letters are stolen property, which makes the man who sent them to Boston not only seditious but a thief. I have endured the accusations until now. I too believed this was simply an annoyance that would pass. But, Doctor, I did not expect to end up fighting a duel. If I had killed him... He paused, leaned forward, his hands on his knees, said slowly, Dr. Franklin, I was willing to keep silent about your involvement with the Hutchinson letters because your service to the colonies is of enormous value, but I cannot have my name destroyed in the newspapers. And, sir, did you not hear me? William Whatley is insisting on another duel. Franklin moved to his small desk, sat, turned the pen slowly in the inkwell. I heard you, Mr. Temple. Enough of this. I had no intention of making you or anyone else a scapegoat. Those letters are my responsibility and mine alone. I do not need my friends to absorb the consequences that I alone deserve. You are involved in this matter through no fault of your own. Just because you had close dealings with the Whatley estate, you came under suspicion. I never spoke out because it all seemed inconsequential. The newspapers moaning and groaning about private letters finding their way public. Mr. Temple, every letter I receive now arrives to me opened. My mail has not been private for some time. The lack of privacy has become routine. He stared at the blank paper. Your description is regrettably accurate. I have been both arrogant and naive. Regardless, I have done you a great wrong, Mr. Temple. Mr. Whatley is entitled to know the truth. They are all entitled to know the truth. Temple regarded him, said, I am grateful, sir. You do understand that if you admit your involvement, it is quite likely there will be an official response. Franklin stared at the paper, raised the pen from the inkwell, rolled it in his hand. If I had reason to feel like something of a target before, this will seal things properly. Please excuse me, Mr. Temple, I have work to do. The letter appeared in London's Public Advertiser on Christmas Day, a frank and complete admission that it was Franklin alone who bore responsibility for securing the Hutchinson letters and no one else. As the ministry pondered what action to take toward this increasingly troublesome man, the formal petitions arrived from the Massachusetts Assembly, carefully worded demands that Governor Hutchinson be removed from office. As with any petition from the colonial assemblies, it was the proper responsibility of the colony's agent to present the petitions before a hearing of the King's Privy Council. And the agent for Massachusetts was still Ben Franklin. January 1774. The two men were stiff, formal, sat across from him like two schoolmasters. He had not expected to need legal representation, considered that he had always been able to handle a confrontation with anyone in official government. But the advice had been unanimous, and even his friend, Strawn, had insisted that Franklin not face the wrath of the ministry alone. Franklin studied the grim faces, focused on the older man, John Dunning, quiet, sober, having the confidence of vast experience from a term as Solicitor General. Dunning said something under his breath, as was something of a habit for him, small comments meant for no one but himself. Beside him was the younger man, small, pale, by the name of John Lee, a man whose reputation in the legal community was still growing, whose deep ambitions were well hidden by a friendly, somewhat simple expression. Lee seemed to ignore Dunning's odd, nearly silent recitation, but Franklin studied the older man's mouth, tried to read the words, thought, "I hope he doesn't give the impression that he's mad. That might not help my situation." Dunning completed his private conversation and turned to Franklin.
"Dr. Franklin, they do not have the power to coerce you into revealing the source of the letters. This is not a criminal proceeding. There are no accusations of wrongdoing to which you must respond."
Franklin looked at Lee, who said, "Quite, sir. However, it is best left alone, you know. The letters themselves, I mean, I would not advise calling them into evidence in any way to support the Massachusetts petitions. It is best to allow the petitions to speak for themselves. The Assembly has done its job. It is in our best interests for us to simply allow the Ministry to do theirs." Dunning brought his hands together, folded his fingers into one wrinkled mass.
"The letters serve two purposes, Doctor, quite at odds with each other. Governor Hutchinson's rather harsh viewpoint toward his subjects may have incited considerable wrath in Boston, but in London his is a view held by many, especially many of those who will hear these petitions. I have no doubt that the outcome of this case has been decided behind closed doors even now. Governor Hutchinson is a loyal subject of the King, and the letters enforce that. As any kind of support to your cause, they are useless."
Lee nodded. "Agreed. In fact, Doctor, the only case you can make is that the people of Massachusetts are discontented and find their relationship with their governor to be odious. The existence of the petitions themselves is proof of that. If you have any further function in the hearing, it will be to reinforce the suggestion that the King would be best served if the people of Massachusetts are content, and thus, to keep them that way, Hutchison should be removed." Franklin absorbed the logic, felt a strange weakness.
Do you believe I have any reason to expect some personal problems from the hearing?"
Dunning sat back, looked over his nose at Franklin.
"Hardly. They may not like you, but that's not a punishable offense."
There was a knock at the door, the faint tapping from Mrs. Stevenson, the small voice hesitating.
"Forgive me, Doctor. There is an urgent message for you."
What else can happen? Franklin wondered. He opened the door and she handed him a folded piece of paper, the seal already broken. Typical now, with all his mail. There were other letters as well, and one fell into his hand, the blessed handwriting of his wife. "Thank you, madam. I had hoped for some word." He closed the door, scanned the others, would not read them yet, said, "Excuse me, gentlemen, but if you will allow me one brief indulgence, it is rare indeed for me to receive a letter from my wife."
"Certainly, Doctor, by all means."
Franklin read the letter, newsy, gossip and business, small tidbits of joy, tales of Sally, the goings-on of the neighbors. "She is quite in a fine mood, I am happy to see that." He glanced up at the two men. "One can never predict." He kept reading, but the letter was complete, as brief as so many others, his eyes following her words to the very last, and now he laughed. "Forgive me. No matter what else may occur, no matter how much news of the mundane, she never fails to bring a smile. She would never understand, of course." He held out the letter now, and Lee leaned forward.
"I'm sorry, Doctor, what—"
"Deborah is many things, gentlemen, but she is no master of letters. Her poor spelling is always challenging, if endearing. She concludes this letter with what must surely be a unique closing." He showed them the letter again, pointing out the closing. "Your affectionate wife. A-F-E-C-K-S-H-O-N-E-T. Both men smiled, even Dunning breaking the stern expression. Franklin sifted through the other papers, saw another one with a colonial seal, broken as well.
"Forgive me, this appears to be official. Boston, actually."
He unfolded the paper, read slowly, studied the words, felt them carving deep into his brain, working their way down, drilling through the calm, the quiet center of his confidence. He felt suddenly like laughing, but it was not humor. It was the only way he could react to something so unknown and terrifying. He felt his eyes fill, blinked hard, turned slowly, both men watching him. Lee was leaning forward, curious, Dunning more discreet, feigning disinterest.
"Gentlemen, I fear the climate may have changed somewhat." It seems that in Boston, a goodly amount of the king's tea was cast rather unceremoniously into the harbor. Lee was suddenly wide-eyed.
How much tea?
Franklin studied the paper again, the laughter still pushing at him from inside. Apparently, all of it. Dunning held out his hand.
If I may, Doctor.
Franklin handed him the missive. Dunning read silently, then handed the letter to Lee. After a quiet moment, Lee said,
Indeed, at a cost of nearly £10,000. Well, Doctor, if the Ministry had to search for some reason to dislike you before, the task has become somewhat easier.
January 29th, 1774. The hearing was called to take place in the Cockpit Tavern, a sprawling den of political wrangling and somber debate that sat close to the offices of Whitehall Palace. The most influential of the King's ministers and advisers, the Privy Council, had scheduled the event as the formal airing of the Massachusetts petition, but the enthusiasm and anticipation from those who were crushed into the tavern's limited space betrayed any semblance that this was just another official hearing. This was an opportunity for an official forum to finally strike back at the colonies by acting against the man who had become a symbol for all the disagreeable rumblings and traitorous outbursts London had so placidly endured. He filed into the tavern's meeting hall close behind his two counselors, and the voices were all around him, a vast hum of barely disguised excitement. He wore his finest suit of Manchester velvet, and his most formal, if now somewhat dated, wig. He tried not to look around, stared ahead to the one long table where the ministers already sat. Dunning and Lee led him to the far end of the room, beside the rolling warmth from a wide fireplace. Behind the table, other men stepped into place, and Franklin tried to hide his reaction, was shocked to see the familiar faces, the extraordinary show of official presence. Behind the seated officials stood the Prime Minister, Lord North, speaking to Lord Dartmouth. He began to feel amazement, could not help but look at the faces in the crowd now, the men all standing, huddled together, their energies surging forward, the room pulsing with the pure power. His eye caught the burst of finery of church officials, and he was stunned now, thought, "My God, it's the Archbishop of Canterbury and the Bishop of London." The men were not looking at him, seemed engrossed in conversation, and Franklin scanned the crowd again, saw many were looking at him, saw one man, now barely visible, the familiar flat wig barely disguising the bald head. The man struggled through the crowd, emerged behind the table, settled in behind the official panel, planting himself firmly in plain view. Franklin nodded to the man, polite instinct, said under his breath, "Lord Hillsborough." Hillsborough stared at him, did not respond, his face locked in a tight, satisfied smile. Beside Franklin, Dunning was speaking to himself, and Franklin, feeling a wave of dread, fought the urge to nudge him, a slight jab of the elbow, thought, "Not now, I need you here." Now another man moved behind the table, carrying a glow of self-importance. He looked across at Franklin, and Franklin felt a sudden cold stab. Behind him, Lee leaned close.
"You do know Lord Wedderburn?"
Franklin nodded, and Lee said,
"Bought and paid for, you know."
Franklin considered Wedderburn, who spoke briefly to the seated ministers, still watching Franklin with a cold stare. Franklin had never known the man socially, knew only that he was once a significant thorn in the side of the king's political interests, a vocal and effective speaker for the opposition. But suddenly Wedderburn was transformed, and the talk was pretty definite that his loyalties had been quite simply for sale, and the king's men had paid the price. But despite the cash value of his loyalty, Wedderburn had a reputation as a fearless attorney, a man any counselor dreaded to see on the opposing side. With a reputation for grand spectacle in the court, and a disregard for both facts and evidence, he was considered more of a showman than a legal mind. As Franklin felt the man's hard glare, his dread increased to a dense wave of gloom, his mind clouded by the noise and the smoke and the fire beside him. So Wedderburn will provide the great show, the entertainment for this extraordinary audience. Franklin looked down now, thought of the advice from Dunning. No, there is nothing they can really do to me. Not here. This is about symbols. A show of strength from a government that has been unable to do little else. I have chosen to be in this place, after all. This is my doing. I cannot argue, I cannot protest, I cannot interrupt. Let them have their say. My greatest strengths will be patience and endurance. All right, Mr. Wedderburn, I am prepared. Franklin had been impressed with Dunning's brief presentation. His soft voice carrying a powerfully dignified message to the assembled crowd, interpreting the formal request for Hutchinson's removal as a polite favor, not a demand. The milder formulation was put to the panel as being in the best interests of the king, not merely the radical complaining of a group of colonial malcontents. But Wedderburn responded by speaking for over an hour, and the rhetoric was just as Franklin had supposed. Wedderburn's argument was simple. How could a governor be removed if his greatest offense was that his subjects disliked him because he vehemently supported the policies of the king? But after the main issue of the petition was argued, Wedderburn had begun to aim his loud oratory toward the one man whom everyone in the audience had come to see. There had been few quiet moments, Wedderburn not allowing his own momentum to flag, but now he stood silently, and Franklin stared at him as he had through the entire tirade, tried to maintain a calm, stoic expression. Wedderburn allowed the quiet to fill the room, the audience slowly leaning forward, expectant, and Franklin thought, "Yes, very good, sir, so you know how to play the audience." Finally, Wedderburn said, "The petition against Governor Hutchinson is an exemplary piece of hostility toward a man who simply performs his good service. You are to consider removing this man from that service because his assembly dislikes him." There was laughter, a scattering of applause. Franklin did not look at the audience, stayed focused on Wedderburn, who waited for the distractions to pass. Now he leaned forward between two of the ministers, pressed his hands down on the table, said in a low, hard growl, "All the ill will, all the turmoil and loss of confidence the crown has suffered may be properly laid at the feet of the man who soils this proceeding with his presence." There was a faint gasp from the crowd, and Franklin thought, "All right, now we will have the grand show." "We do not know how Dr. Franklin came to possess Governor Hutchinson's private letters. As his counsel has so ably pointed out, he is not obliged to tell us. Therefore, nothing will acquit Dr. Franklin of the charge of obtaining them by fraudulent or corrupt means for the most malignant of purposes. If he did not steal them himself, then he most certainly stole them from the original thief. This sordid episode thus provides us with an enormous irony, this man being so very pleased to refer to himself as a man of letters." There was more laughter, louder this time, and Franklin allowed himself to scan the audience slowly, saw a number of familiar faces who did not share the laughter of the high-spirited men and who stared at Wedderburn with undisguised outrage. He could see military uniforms now, a pair of high-ranking officers who had joined the crowd. He did not know them, but they were clearly enjoying Wedderburn's sharp tongue. The sounds began to diminish, and Wedderburn continued, "No position can be more of consequence than the private letters of friendship. This property is as sacred and as precious to gentlemen of integrity as their family plate or jewels. Will Dr. Franklin avow the principle that he has a right to possess such letters by any means possible, and to make all private letters his own, to apply them to whatever evil he chooses? He dared to reveal these precious letters to 6 people in Massachusetts. Would Dr. Franklin like me to name the 6? Privacy, indeed." Franklin felt a short pinch in his throat.
a burst of protest rising. He held it tightly, told himself, "No, I cannot interrupt." But how curious that Wedderburn would know who received the letters if he did not in fact have access to my own private mail. He was feeling a wave of exhaustion now, the stamina that had allowed him to endure the hostile rhetoric slipping away. "Get hold of yourself, old man. You can show them nothing, no reaction. Do not even consider trading barbs with a man who is so much a master." "What purpose is served by inflaming the minds of the colony toward their governor? It is obvious. Dr. Franklin and his constituents desire no less than to remove the crown's influence and establish themselves into a tyranny greater than the Roman. This man desires nothing less than to find himself the successor to Governor Hutchinson. What a cruel miscalculation to believe that this body would succumb to such a scheme by carelessly removing one so loyal." He leaned forward again, pounded his fist on the table. "I hope, my lords, you will mark and brand this man for the honor of this country, of Europe, and of mankind. He has forfeited all respect of societies and of gentlemen. Into what company will he go now with an unembarrassed face or the reputation of honest virtue? Men will watch him with a jealous eye, they will hide their papers from him, lock their libraries. What cool and apathetic evil, what revengeful temper will this man, this wily American, bring to civilized society?" Franklin blinked hard, the weariness complete. "Yes, Mr. Wedderburn, you have gone far across any line here. But what does it matter? If he is trying to incite me into some kind of outburst, I will not give him, any of them, the satisfaction. Anger is simply momentary madness, and sometimes there is strength in silence. After all, he is only throwing words, not stones." Wedderburn went on, calmer now, a brief anticlimactic closing. Franklin's mind was swimming, and he fought to stay attentive, his energy all devoted to maintaining the expression on his face, which was no expression at all. Now Dunning spoke, surprising him, his attention snapping to the words. "With respect to this body, Dr. Franklin declines to be examined directly." Wedderburn was silent now, and the chairman of the council said, "There is no reason to delay. This body has reached a determination that the petitions of the Massachusetts Assembly are founded upon resolutions formed upon false and erroneous allegations, and that the same are groundless, vexatious, and scandalous, and calculated only for the seditious purposes of keeping up a spirit of clamor and discontent in the province of Massachusetts. This hearing is now adjourned." The voices of the audience rose, some applauding the decision, some calling out in angry protest. Franklin felt himself pulled, his arms held by Dunning and Lee, felt himself moving through the crowd. His head was spinning, the heat and the exhaustion threatening to pull his legs out from under him. He could hear the voices close to him now, men shouting into his face, outrage, talk of revenge, some toward him, some toward Wedderburn. He felt a sharp coolness was outside now, the two men guiding him up into a carriage, a sudden lurch of motion. There was no talk from the two men seated across from him, who watched him with quiet concern. The carriage moved quickly through the dark streets, the daylight already gone. He felt himself breathing heavily, his mind a chaos of words, the voice of Wedderburn, the vitriol and venom, the sarcastic rhetoric, the abusive accusations. He looked at the two men who were still watching him, managed a slight smile, said, "Difficult day." January 31st, 1774. It was 2 days after the extraordinary hearing, and he had spent the previous day entertaining a constant parade of well-wishers. Word was all over London, and even Loyalists were outspoken about Wedderburn's abuse. The talk had been the same all day long, friends and acquaintances offering him kind words, many convinced that he should leave London immediately, some even encouraging him to challenge Wedderburn to a duel. He had met them all with graciousness, surprised at the general outrage, the anger toward the government on his behalf. The day had concluded with the arrival of a letter, the perfect capstone to the grotesque experience. He had been terminated as Postmaster General for the colonies. He had slept late, had calmly obeyed Mrs. Stevenson's insistence that he keep the visitors away today. He acknowledged what she clearly observed, that his graciousness was drained away. She had waited for him to rise at his own time, had brought him his tea, and he had seen a concern in her eyes, something unusual, something that seemed like fear. I must have looked a fright through this whole episode. He laughed quietly, thought of the spectacle of Wedderburn pounding the table. Have they no sympathy for a 68-year-old man? He sat at the small desk, sipped the tea. He stared into the cup, could not help thinking of salt water.
It must have been extraordinary. Men dressed as Indians.
There will be no convictions, of course, the same problem for the law they had during the whole Gaspé incident. What do you do, arrest the whole town? But there is a case for restitution. £10,000, an enormous amount of money, and someone will want it paid back. Still, I wish I had been there to see it. He had thought of working, trying to write more of his autobiography, but the words were not there. The weight of the hearing had not left him. It wasn't exhaustion anymore, it was sadness. Becoming deeper now, his mind sinking into a black pool of depression. It is not regret, he thought. You have performed an important duty. There is so little communication, so little understanding. They will probably publish Wedderburn's speech, edited, of course, leaving out the ridiculousness. But it will still be effective, will certainly defame me all over England, a good splash of dirt on my character. Wedderburn will crow about his great success. The ministers will congratulate each other on their wise vindication of Governor Hutchinson, and none of them will understand what has really happened, what the results of this will certainly be. He had begun to write a letter to his friend Cushing. His explanation of what had taken place, a warning that as the receiver of the letters, Cushing might come under some scrutiny of his own. But the sadness had flowed out of him with the words, and he thought of the real lesson of the hearing, what no one in England would understand. If the people have grievances, and the government is so closed to hearing them that the mere pipeline, the messenger who conveys them, is brutally censured, how are peace and union to be maintained? We are so far apart that problems are too easily ignored. Grievances and complaints cannot be addressed unless they are known, and they cannot be known unless petitions are heard. If the mere delivery of a petition is considered an offence, and the messengers are so abused, then who will perform the duty? It is a dangerous thing for any state to maintain its power by plugging up the vent of complaints, stifling the voices of the people. When complaining becomes a crime, hope becomes despair. He finished the tea, looked around the room, saw his velvet suit still spread on a chair. At least I made a good appearance. The most important thing sometimes, an effective tool for standing up to abuse. After all, you're used to it, old man. It's part of the job, always has been. A public official must have a thick skin. If they believe their attack has harmed me, has somehow removed my resolve, they are mistaken. And this is no conclusion to anything, no completion of any task, no solution to any problem. This is one more symptom of the great illness that is still spreading between the Crown and its colonies. All the bluster and rhetoric, and still no wisdom. And we must still answer for the tea. Chapter 18. Gage. London, February the 4th, 1774. He had enjoyed himself at first,
caught up in the swell of emotion that had filled the cockpit tavern. The cheers had all been directed at Wedderburn, the response to the man's amazing command of language, turning the perfect phrase, the juicy insults aimed at deflating the lofty image of Benjamin Franklin. Gage had applauded, even shouted with the men who sat beside him, directing their taunts toward the round old man at the far end of the room. He had always been outraged about anyone tampering with the mails, had never allowed it in his own command. It was the one pure sanctuary of privacy. A man's words, thoughts, emotions communicated to an intimate. There was never any doubt that what a man wrote in a letter was never intended as public. No one should ever have to fear a sudden burst of light into the quiet darkness of one's own thoughts, no matter how indiscreet they were, no matter whom they might offend. Unlike many in the noisy audience, though, Gage had come to understand that Franklin was only the most visible offender in regard to a practice that had become commonplace. Since Gage had been in London, he had learned that beyond Ben Franklin's amazing abuse of Governor Hutchinson's privacy, the opening of mail was actually becoming official policy. Whether someone was considered a potential threat to the government had become a judgment made by anyone from King George himself to the offices of Lord North, or even, lately, the most junior clerk at the mail offices. Gage was immediately nervous about this sudden lapse of personal security, found himself editing his own letters, suddenly rereading his own words to ferret out any innocent reference that might be misinterpreted, any strong words that might cause indigestion in some bureaucrat. It had occurred to him with a stir of uneasiness that someone might possibly put some undue emphasis on his wife's being born an American. As much as he joined in the enthusiastic gloating over Lord Wedderburn's assault on Franklin, Gage held the thought in the back of his mind that Franklin might not have done something so terribly evil as to deserve all of this. As the tirade from Wedderburn had begun to drone into its second hour, Gage had begun to focus more on Franklin himself, watching for a telltale break in the old man's composure, an impatient interruption, some reaction from Franklin to the amazing vitriol from the Scottish lawyer. But Franklin had remained perfectly stoic, respectful, even attentive. As the second hour drew to a close, Gage began to feel his sympathies shifting, was aware that many in the audience had begun to react negatively to Wedderburn's graphic hostility. Gage had been prepared to stand himself, make a statement, assist the panel in their consideration of the argument that had prompted the hearing in the first place, the petition to have Governor Hutchinson removed. But when the panel concluded the hearing by ruling immediately in favor of Hutchinson, Gage realized that the audience was paying much closer attention to the strange personal assault on Franklin. By the time Wedderburn wrapped up his remarks, many, Gage included, had heard enough. In the taverns and meeting rooms around the Parliament buildings, there was still talk of the inappropriate abuse of Franklin, but the attention had shifted dramatically with news of the destruction of the tea. If Franklin was a symbol, the visible face who could somehow be blamed, called to task for the general unrest in the colonies, it was hard for anyone to blame him for dumping the tea. In England, the people had endured written abuse for years, the angry tirades in colonial newspapers, published pamphlets, all the mad pronouncements for which the Sons of Liberty had built their infamous reputation. But this was very different. A shocking bit of action. The response in the British newspapers was confused at first. Arguments over financial retribution, who should be made to pay and how. The destruction of the tea was an assault on private property, English property, and there were immediate calls for restitution to find some means of forcing the colonists to pay the East India Company for the loss. But this was an economics problem, and the people were reacting more with emotion. Few of the voices in the taverns and on the street cared for economic solutions to anything. Finally, the newspapers began to shout along with the people. In one great swell of English pride, the masses began to use a new word formerly reserved for those most hostile to the annoying sounds from the colonial rabble. The word was punishment.
Gage had been supremely disappointed by the reception he had received in England. In fact, there had been very little reception at all. Margaret's pregnancy kept her close to home, the grand estate of his brother, known as High Meadow, while Gage's own time was spent mostly in mundane sightseeing trips. Margaret had finally felt well enough to come with him to London, and it was then that the baby decided to surprise both parents by a sudden arrival. It was a girl, born in mid-August. While Margaret and the baby spent the autumn months back at High Meadow, Gage had tried to find a welcome in many of the ministry offices in London, had even been granted a brief audience with King George. But the visits were formal, stiff affairs of no substance, simply polite acknowledgement of the general's visit. There was no invitation to speak to Parliament, and, for the most part, no invitations at all. The fantasy of the brass bands and great parades had vanished. But with England's boiling response to the destruction of the tea, his frustrating invisibility had suddenly changed. He was, after all, still the commander-in-chief of His Majesty's forces in America. And now there would be another audience with the King, and no one expected this meeting to be as meaningless as the last. "You may enter, General. Please confine yourself to discussion of events upon which His Majesty addresses you." Gage moved past the King's official greeter, nodded silently, peered ahead through the great wide doors of the King's official chamber. He was not sure if the meeting would be private, had experienced in his first visit the strange audience that spread around the vast room, government officials, military men. They sat as if they never moved, never left the room, were somehow designated as the King's official attendants. He saw the faces watching him as he stepped primly into the chamber, polite smiles, disinterested idle stares, one familiar face above the stark grandeur of his uniform, General James Patterson. Gage made a brief nod, returned by Patterson. And now, in one single motion, they all stood, and at the far side of the chamber, a door opened, and Gage saw a flurry of scarlet, the long coat draped over the man's shoulders, a final touch by a petite handmaiden, who was swept aside with an impatient wave. The King seemed to blow into the room, the bright red swirling around white silk. He ignored the audience, stared directly at Gage, moved to the great heavy chair, green satin and dark wood, sat heavily, rubbed his hands together, smiled. "Shall we have a war, General?" Gage made a deep bow, rose slowly, heard the men behind him sitting again. "I am honored to be again in the presence of Your Majesty." "Yes, yes, so, a war? Put this matter to rest once and for all?" Gage glanced at the King's face, a brief look, knew the protocol that it was highly insulting to look the monarch directly in the eye. "Forgive me, Your Majesty, I am not certain to what you refer." The King grunted, waved his arm in a wide arc. "Perhaps you should join the statuary here. I had thought you would be more animated. You've lived with them long enough. I should think you would understand what is so plainly obvious to me." Gage rolled the words over in his mind, suddenly realized the King was offering him an opportunity. "Yes, Your Majesty. I believe I understand the problem with the colonies. My command is prepared to offer Your Majesty a solution with your permission." The King stared away for a long moment, and Gage glanced at his face, saw the pale softness bathed in a faint glow of light from a tall window across the room. The King seemed to converse with himself, his expression changing slightly, a small frown, and then he turned back to Gage. "I'd rather miss George Grenville. He's dead, you know. A monarch requires the services of a man who understands numbers, who knows all about the most irritating details of commerce. He was Chancellor of the Exchequer for a time, the perfect man for the job. The Stamp Act was his idea, his plan. It was also his downfall. His problem was that he possessed an orderly mind, and he applied that to a disorderly situation. Chaotic, in fact." The King stared again at the window. "I would like some tea." There was a small commotion through the far doorway, and a small man emerged carrying a silver tray on which was balanced a small silver pitcher beside a round china cup. Gage watched the man pour the tea into the cup, saw the small wisp of steam, thought, Obviously he was prepared. He was impressed now, of course. Good servants anticipate one's needs, as it should be. The man set the cup down on a small table beside the chair, withdrew silently, and the king ignored the cup, looked at Gage again.
"I have tried to govern this kingdom with wisdom, General. I have learned the value of persuasion and the value of force. In London, the ills of government are often best cured with the administering of gold pills. Spread the medicine properly and the ills vanish. Persuasion doesn't work with colonials, General. I have heard all the tiresome metaphors. They are like children. They are merely farms to provide for the mother country. They are the ground upon which the polished boots of the empire tread. I tire so of newspapers." He leaned forward now, pointed a finger at Gage. "Until now. Now I rather enjoy the newspapers." Gage waited for more, and the king sat back in the chair, blew out a short, hard breath. "You're supposed to ask me why." Gage bowed his head slightly. "Forgive me, Your Majesty. Why does Your Majesty enjoy the newspapers?" George's voice boomed.
"Because they finally agree with me. The people are speaking out, and the newspapers are finally paying attention. The people have always understood the right course. You can always count on the English spirit, our resolve to direct the empire on the right course."
Gage nodded, said nothing, hoped there would be an explanation.
"Who destroyed the tea, General?"
Gage rolled the possible answers through his mind, began to feel a bead of sweat on his lip. "They call themselves the Sons of Liberty, Your Majesty."
"Sons of Liberty, sons of insurrection, sons of barbarism. That was George Grenville's mistake. Apply a rational solution to an irrational problem. Impose a civilized policy on savages. Didn't work then, not going to work now. This is not about taxes. We can impose taxes anywhere we desire. This is an issue involving nothing less than the authority of the monarchy over its subjects. That authority is not just being questioned. It is being overruled. Don't you agree, General?"
Gage sensed the opportunity again. "Your Majesty, if I may be so bold, my command has requested the presence of troops in the colonies, a great many more troops than have been provided. This latest outbreak of lawlessness confirms that need. As long as the colonists have no fear of reprisal, they strut like lions while we are seen as lambs. If we show resolve, all those traitorous voices will fall silent. With all respect to the soul of Mr. Grenville, my command believes there is only one method useful in defeating a rebellion." The king bellowed again.
"Rebellion, yes!"
"I have been saying that for some time now. Use the word, don't be afraid of it. So many of my ministers are hesitant to describe the situation for what it is. They fear the opposition, those absurd fools in Parliament who build their notoriety by speaking out against my policies, as though by disagreeing with their king they establish themselves as some sort of heroes. And until lately, the newspapers have played their game well no more. We have a rebellion on our hands. The English people have united in the cause. The Empire will prevail, and you—"
He pointed at Gage, and there was a silent moment. Gage waited for more, felt his heart pounding, the rising excitement of the moment. The king said quietly, "What do you think of Governor Hutchinson?" Gage looked up, met the king's eye, immediately dropped his head.
"Forgive me, Your Majesty. I'm not sure to what Your Majesty refers." "It was a simple question, General." "All right. Too timid to share your opinion. You're not alone, so I'll tell you what I think. He's an adequate governor for the most part. A lot like George Grenville, actually. Orderly mind, loyal, certainly. Puts the empire above all. I require that. An efficient bureaucrat."
The king leaned forward again, pointed his finger close to Gage's face, said,
"And I regret to say, General, he is weak, timid, reluctant to offend the very barbarians who bark and growl at the walls of the empire. So now, General, do you have an opinion about Governor Hutchinson?"
Gage understood at last.
"Yes, Your Majesty, I feel that Governor Hutchinson is all those things as Your Majesty describes."
George sat back again, glanced at the tea beside him, said quietly, "I would like some hot tea." The scene played out again, the small servant appearing with another tray, the first cup replaced by another, the slow rise of steam. The king ignored the cup. Said to Gage, "How many troops?" Gage felt relief. Had hoped to hear that question above all others. He straightened himself, had prepared his answer well. "If your majesty will authorize 4 regiments, my command will place them where they will perform the required service to the empire. The rabble in Boston will be brought under control again. The rebellion will be stopped."
"Crushed, general. It is not enough to stop it. It must be obliterated. Every element, every piece of inspiration, every voice."
"Yes, your majesty, crushed.
There are those in my ministry who feel we should bombard Boston with cannon. Inefficient. Destroying houses doesn't destroy rebellion. It is more about spirit. Don't you agree?"
"Quite so, your majesty. There is a better way. I propose, with your majesty's permission, that we enact stronger measures, that we bring a swift and complete punishment not only on those rebels who shout the loudest, but on those who follow their calls. The punishment must be absolute." He was excited again, and George was nodding, staring at the window. Gage waited, and the king rubbed his face with thick fingers, prodded the soft, chalky roundness, then focused on Gage again, studied the man's uniform as if for the first time.
4 regiments?
"Yes, your majesty. That should be an adequate force to completely eliminate the insurrection as it now threatens Boston. My command does not believe the rebellion will receive assistance from the other colonies. There has been some contagiousness to the disorder in Boston, but once eliminated there, it will be eliminated throughout the colonies." The king stared away again, closed his eyes for a moment, said, "I wish I could be there. I would enjoy watching the terror on their dirty faces, hearing their pitiful cries begging their king's forgiveness. What a joy to behold, to trample the unruly, to crush the spirit of rebellion from their simple minds, allow them to rise again in humble acceptance of their guilt. And then they understand who their king is, how he rules his empire. They will know that I have forgiven them. They will return to the empire cleansed. Their loyalty will never again be questioned." He glanced down at the teacup, sat back in the chair. "I would like some hot tea." Gage watched the servant appear once more, and George was looking at Gage now, a slight smile. "But I would starve them a little first." April 2nd, 1774. He had mostly stayed at High Meadow with Margaret and the children, had tried to find some way to work himself into the affairs of state, find access to the closed doors of government. But no word had come, and the frustration returned, the suspicion that he was simply being ignored while the planning over the crisis in the colonies was played out by conferences of ministers and debates in Parliament. It had been 2 months since his audience with the king, and Gage still had no idea if anything he had said was taken seriously. He had become used to this in New York, hot talk and grand pronouncements in London, resulting in no action at all. It was more than distance, and now that he was close to the talk, he could see that despite all the outcries against the Americans, it might be the talk that would prevail after all. He had begun to look for a home, a quiet fantasy that he might be allowed still to assume some honorary post, accompanied, of course, by a title, the reward for his years of good service. The longer he stayed away from the colonies, the less he wanted to return, and the fantasy of a long retirement in England was strengthened by the silence from the government. He was becoming more convinced each day that his role in colonial affairs was indeed coming to a close. Margaret's health had been unusually fragile. The birth of the baby was now 8 months past, but she had not yet regained her strength. Childbirth had not been difficult for her before, but the doctors seemed concerned about her age, knowing that as a woman grew older, the risks and the complications of giving birth increased. Gage had tried to bolster her strength with a show of optimism, trying to convince her, as much as he tried to convince himself, that this was the best place, the ideal place for all of them. She did not respond, and he knew that there was more to her sickness, something the doctors could not understand. It was not just the childbirth that had pulled her down, it was his talk. his dream that England would be their home. If Gage could not reach her in that dark place in which she seemed to dwell, he had been more successful in insisting that she walk with him each day, enjoy the beauty of the gardens. With the warmer days of spring, it had actually seemed to work, the color in her soft face returning, her stamina increasing, the cold silence giving way to glimpses of kindness. It had been another warm morning, unusual this early in the year, and the hills around High Meadow were already deep green, a flat carpet of wildflowers appearing for the first time, small clusters of faint color. He had pushed the distance a bit, a wider arc across the low hills to the south, a new path she had not yet seen. Now, the walk nearly complete, they moved through the wide garden close to the grand house. She held his arm, and he could feel her sagging against him, moving in a slow rhythm, silent, with soft, quick breathing. They had not spoken in a long while, and now she stopped, took one long breath, said, "Not another step." She looked around, spotted the small bench at one end of the garden. "There, sit with me." They moved together, and he sat her carefully down on the flat stone seat, eyed the narrow space beside her. "A tight fit." She glanced down to the side. "You'll manage." He smiled, slid himself down next to her, close against her, and it did not escape him that it was as near as he had been to her in a long while. The soft quiet returned, a light breeze rolling through a distant stand of trees. She took another deep breath. "How much longer, Thomas?" There was an edge to her voice, surprising him. He had heard the question before, had thought she was satisfied with the answer. He felt a surge of frustration, held on to it tightly, put a hand on her knee, felt the softness of the light wool. "Are you not yet pleased? Is there nothing here that appeals to you?"
"This is not our home, Thomas. We are merely guests."
He heard the accent in her voice now, seemed to hear it most at times like this. Cruel coincidence. It was the only American accent he had heard in months, and he could not escape it, the constant reminder that England was not her home. "Please, Margaret, my brother has allowed us to remain here as long as we need to. Once we find our own estate, we will all be happier. Think of the children." He knew immediately he had made a mistake.
"So now we think of the children? Did it not bother you to send them so far away from New York, so far from their parents?"
It was a familiar argument he knew he could not win. "Margaret, we have been through this. You know that it was best. They had to be schooled in England. They would have little future if they took their education in the colonies." She moved her knee, and he knew the sign, removed his hand. Her softness had changed, her back more stiff.
"I am not so certain of that anymore. There is so much angry talk, so much hostility. I am rather tired of being looked upon by your family as an outsider. I don't relish the thought that my own children may soon regard their mother in the same way."
"Nonsense, Margaret. No one thinks of you as anything other than the wife of General Gage. You need not worry that anyone will treat you with anything but the utmost respect."
"So I am to be pleased that I am nothing but the wife of General Gage?"
"It's not a bad thing, my dear. Certainly."
He did not notice her looking at him, the glare in her eye. He was focused on the servant who emerged from the house. The man spotted them, made his way across the garden. Behind him, two children emerged from the house, running, past the servant, a race, quick shouts, and the larger boy now pulled up close to them, piping, "I won!"
The smaller boy reached his brother's side, tried to stand straight as well, but the loss of the race overcame his attempt at stoicism, and he began to push the older boy, wrapped himself around his brother's legs, tumbling them both to the ground. The servant had reached them now, tried to avoid the chaotic scene erupting near his feet. Margaret was laughing.
"William, do not assault your brother."
Gage leaned down, wrapped his hand around the smaller boy's waist, pulled him free, and the larger boy struggled to his feet.
"I did not hit him, ma'am."
Yes, Henry, you showed admirable restraint.
Gage released the smaller boy.
I don't understand you, William. It does not hold much promise to pick a fight with your big brother. Your success is best gained by attacking a weaker foe, not a stronger one. A good general knows that.
The smaller boy now stood at attention, saluted his father, and the older boy said,
"He's better today. I heard him coughing last night, but not this morning."
"William, come here," Margaret said, reaching out.
The smaller boy rushed into her arms, and she held him away for a moment, studied his face.
"You have good color today. Feeling all right?"
William squirmed free.
"I can run all the way around the house."
He dashed away, and Gage said to the older boy, "Stay close to him, Henry."
The older boy made a bow, said to Margaret, "Mummy," and was gone in quick pursuit of his brother. Margaret watched them.
"He seems to be better."
"Don't worry, my dear.
But don't you see, they love it here."
The servant stepped forward now, balanced a flat silver tray on his palm. Gage watched the boys disappear around the side of the great house.
"Sorry, Holt, what is it?"
The servant made a brief bow, held the tray out toward him.
"General, this just came for you. We were told it was rather urgent."
Gage picked up the folded letter from the tray, nodded toward the servant, the silent command, and the man backed away, retraced his steps toward the house. Gage glanced at Margaret, saw her staring down.
"Rather a grand seal on this one."
He began to feel the anticipation now, made a small show of breaking the wax, looked at her again, wanted her to share the moment. But she would not look at him, and his disappointment quickly passed, his attention now focused on the letter. He unfolded the thick paper, glanced at the bottom, felt a new stab of excitement.
"It's from Lord North himself."
He read for a long moment, felt the air slowly leaving him, his knees growing weaker. He sat down beside her again, lowered the paper, and she said,
"So, are you a duke now?"
He sat silently, her words drifting past him. He began to shake his head.
"I did not think. I had thought the king..."
She looked at him now, a long quiet moment, her softness returning. "What is it, Thomas?" He stared at the paper again, the shock giving way to a bolt of anger, a sharp assault directed inside at himself.
"It was foolish of me to believe they would allow me to remain here. A commander does not step away from his command in time of crisis. I thought the king was engaging me. I thought I was merely His Majesty's entertainment. I didn't know he was serious, that he would actually follow through."
"Follow through on what, Thomas?"
"I asked that my command be given 4 regiments, that the troops be sent to Boston to quell the unrest. I had thought, I assumed General Haldimand would manage the affair as I had instructed him. But it seems the king has other ideas."
He stopped, felt an emptiness in his chest, straightened himself, took a long deep breath. He looked at her now, expected to see cold satisfaction, her wishes realized, the months of pulling away from this place finally successful. He wanted to be angry with her, blame her somehow, but she put a hand on his arm, and he saw only her deep concern. He shook his head, held up the letter.
"Lord North, it's official. I have been ordered to resume my post, but not in New York. I am to sail immediately to Boston. The ministry wants me in command of the troops. But that's not all of it."
He looked at the letter again, fought through the disbelief.
"Once in Boston, I am to assume control of the civil government. Thomas Hutchinson is being relieved of his position. I have been appointed governor of Massachusetts."
This ends Disc 7.